Welcome to SILRAP Podcasts. You are about to listen to a service of the Center for International Law Research and Policy.
Hello, everyone. Let me try to do something animated after the lunch. And unfortunately, I don't have the slides, so this is all we can do. Let me take this away. My laptop stayed at JFK on the way in, so we'll have to improvise. First of all, let me say that the paper that we are preparing for this conference is done by the moderator and myself, Chris Mahoney, my colleague, and basically, I would like to start with referring to the title of this actual panel, because it says other external powers. So let me say that, first of all, that there's different dimensions of exogeneity involved here when UNDP is concerned. I mean, the first level of external is really the fact that, to a large extent, we're an organization that is not involved with academic work, but really with global national policy and programming through which the practice really comes through. So given that this is mostly an academic discussion, we are trying to plug into it, but really our perspective is of a multilateral organization that comes into this, and obviously from a standpoint of power, that should be taken into account. The second thing is that we are a development organization. So we are not an organization that has an international justice mandate. We don't have, though we are certainly guided by human rights in normative terms, we don't have a mandate to monitor human rights or basically we are not norm setting body like OHCHR, for example. We also don't have a political mandate at all in our framework. So I think it takes a little bit of explaining as why we're here, actually. And then the final thing that also puts us aside from the other presentations is really that our mandate is completely and exclusively limited to the national prosecutions of the core international crimes. So we are, by default, the champions of the courts of first instance. And it's in that framework that I will be trying to talk a little bit about power and autonomy. So I propose to first say something more about UNDP's role and what we do, and how the issue of complementarity comes into this picture. And then I will say something about how, in fact, power is understood in development frameworks. Development in peace building, because I think this is the critical point here in order to understand how we look at these issues from our standpoint. So first of all, let me say that as far as the national prosecutions are concerned, UNDP got involved very much so from the field onward, not from the headquarters. So it was not a global policy initially, and that's usually with how thematically we get involved on issues. But really, it's the governments who approached UNDP at the country level and asked for assistance with war crime prosecutions. That happened in Bosnia. It eventually happened in Colombia, in Guatemala, and so on. So by the time we came to the point in 2010 of the ICC Review Conference, UNDP already had a fairly sizable involvement in the Balkans, in Bosnia, Serbia, and Croatia, Guatemala, Colombia, DRC. And nowadays, there's also other countries in which we also work on, including CAR and Tunisia. Tunisia certainly doesn't seem to be rising to the level of core international crimes, but certainly there is a component of national prosecutions that is part of the broader transitional justice framework that government set up. So all these things have already happened, and at that point, there was a lot of debate in UNDP whether UNDP should be part of this conversation at all. And should, in fact, be at the ICC at the ICC table. And that is all in connection to the conversation about complementarity. And just to remind those who usually think of complementarity really related to issues between international and national jurisdictions, at that point, the discussion was really framed around national prosecutions per se, and the definition of complementarity that is involved in that particular document that was developed and the discussion that followed there was a stock-taking section, basically, on the principles of complementarity. And this is how, in the background paper, the complementarity was defined, as all activities and actions whereby national jurisdictions are strengthened and enabled to conduct genuine national investigations and trials of crimes included in the Rome Statute without involving the court in capacity building, financial support, and technical assistance, but instead leaving these actions and activities for states to assist each other on a voluntary basis. So there was a point where the thinking was that the court, and especially the secretariats, are all overwhelmed in terms of their capacity. And at that point, there was also acknowledged that development actors should be basically invited to be part of this discussion. And so under the leadership of our former administrator, who was supposed to be at this conference, in fact, Helen Clark, the former Prime Minister of New Zealand and also the administrator of UNDP, the decision was made that, yes, UNDP does this on the ground, and this is something that we do want to get involved in. And in fact, we did get we became part of this discussion and committed to work with it. The thinking was that, in fact, not only from the UNDP side, but I think also from the international justice trend at the time, that there, if you are developing national capacity to prosecute core international crimes, you are better off if you do using infrastructures that are already there. Development partners are usually already involved with the sector. They're there for a long time, understand the situation, understand the sector, have developed partnerships, and have often programs that can, in one way or another, prompt the bigger picture of building the capacities that are needed. So that can be related on a very different scale of issues, whether it's developing line ministries or introducing particular international legislation of different kind in the national frameworks. It could be related to witness protection. It could be related to outreach capacities of courts for, let's say, corruption or sexual and gender-based violence. So all of these practices can, in fact, be used to prompt things. On the other hand, there was also the logic that if the courts and if this particular fight against impunity at the national level is to make a difference and buy off the constituencies, these efforts should also, in many ways, invest in justice systems of the national courts so that they can take this work and continue this work. So that would be the real legacy of getting involved on the broader scale. So that was some of the thinking that we had in regards to the involvement. And basically, UNDP has since been involved in the conversation with a number of countries that had gone through the process from building their own capacity, from Guatemala and Colombia and DRC to the Balkan countries and Sierra Leone. There was a conversation that was organized by UNDP and International Center for Transitional Justice, as well as the governments of Denmark and South Africa, who were really the coordinators of this particular section of the working group on complementarity in the Assembly of State Parties. So 3 consecutive years after the ICC Review Conference, This was really a topic that was discussed, and we tried to do quite a bit of South-South cooperation and putting people together into a network to support each other on these issues. I don't have time, and I think it would not be well spent here, to talk about country cases. There's different things we do in different countries. In Colombia, we started with justice and peace law. There is a Justicia and Convivencia trust funds that coordinates lots of different actors. And Justicia one was obviously the one that did national persecutions. They were going slowly and so on and so forth. In Guatemala, we work with the Attorney General's office. We put a lot of resources to build that capacity. In the Balkans, we actually work with three prosecutor's offices. We try to support the process through which they made bilateral agreements, through which they agreed to exchange documentation and facilitate witnesses to go from one country to the other. And in DRC, we used the infrastructures on the ground in Eastern Congo to basically support the military prosecutions of the military prosecutions specifically for gender-based crimes. Having said this, so this kind of explains how we actually got to this topic. Now, let me try to say something about how development really comes into the picture when power is concerned. Obviously, I said that we simply don't have a political mandate, and the reality is that the world power really doesn't come into UNDP documents very often. However, I think there is a way in which we try to bring it into the picture in a very strong way. And you see it mainly in the frameworks, such as Agenda 2030, where SDG 16 creates very clear connections between development and peace and development. There's no peace without development, and no development without peace. Unlike the MDG 16, Millennium Development Goals for 2015, this new framework really looks at the connections, and the trend is really that development should be helping with prevention of conflict altogether. This is also what the twin resolutions by Security Council and the GA, it's the resolution 2282 in the Security Council, that really talks about sustaining peace based on several reviews of the UN, including the UN peacebuilding architecture and HIPPO reports on peacekeeping, as well as there were reviews of the 1325 on gender equality in conflict settings, and then on youth as well. So all of these brought about a particular new strategy for sustaining peace. And all of these see a particular need for development to come into the picture and take on a role in preventing collective violence, basically. So the trend is similar in a number of other areas, including prevention of violent extremism, in terms of drug policy, and so on. I'm not going to go into the details. I would like to also then draw your attention to the report that's been now prepared, and the first installment came out. It's a companion during the UNGA this year. It's a report jointly done by the UN and the World Bank, and it's called Pathways for Peace. It's this thing here. It so happens that basically Chris and myself are part of the team that is drafting this report, which in many ways tries to update the prevention strategies that exist since, let's say, 2011 with the World Development Report on development, conflict, and security, and also related to G7 plus context of peace building and state building. And so this report really provides a framework to think about prevention. And I would like to give a couple of words about this framework, and then I would basically draw some implications for specifically national prosecutions of international crimes. So one of the things that report puts right and center is really the issue of that exists very much in already in the development framers. That's the issues of inclusion and exclusions. And so we're really looking at institutions mostly and processes and the way through which certain groups become either excluded or excluded. If you look at, for example, SDG 16, it talks about inclusive, just, and peaceful societies as a goal, and that's the goal that ties the peace and development parts. But what we try to do in this report is to look at different kind of inequalities and see, on the basis of available data and research done since 2011, try to find, in fact, whether there are any correlations that are statistically important for our work and then build policy on it. And have largely found that, yes, I mean, inequalities on individual basis in many respects, political, social, economic, educational, cultural, and so on, do exist and overlap to some extent. But it's really the what we call the horizontal inequalities that largely should be seen in terms of modern terms of conflict as the drivers. Or what you call the underlying risks of conflict. And so this is really exclusions of groups or marginalization, discrimination, and this kind of social practice that puts aside one group against the other has to be obviously acknowledged that these are real and perceived inequalities and exclusions. So the perceived exclusions can have the same effect as the real ones, or the ones that can certainly be backed by data. There is also cases in which those who, in fact, do the exclusions mobilize, in fact, as well. And so the whole idea is to start with grievances. In all this age-old debate between gain, greed and grievance, we are falling back on grievance. And we are trying to basically chart that route going from exclusions to grievances, from grievances to collective identities, and then from collective identities to mobilization. And then the final step towards mobilized groups use violence to further their political or other goals. So this is one of the main things that really drives this, looks at the drivers. We add other risks. I think in the modern world, there's other external risks that also come into the picture, but I don't think we have time for that. What is important is to say that apart from state, we look at non-state actors because non-state actors are clearly much more involved than they have ever been. And we don't only have insurgencies where government is fighting non-state actors, but we also have non-state actors, armed non-state actors fighting armed non-state actors. These kind of contexts with non-state actors are much more difficult to negotiate and find a political settlement. There's less incentives for these groups to do something of a kind. So we also look largely, to go back to Mark's discussion, as 2011 and to some extent the New Deal agenda, we're mostly dealing with institutions and the top-down institutions, so to speak, line ministries and building that. This report tries to actually put attention more on actors and on structural factors. So structural factors would be these very slowly moving parts, such as natural endowments, resources, climate change, could be also traditional culture, and so on and so forth. So we are trying to put that in the context of what we're doing. So how does justice, and specifically justice that looks at international crimes, fit into this picture? Well, first of all, justice is identified as one of the areas of contestation. So if we are having exclusions, we are basically looking at different spaces in which these particular contestation is happening. And so security and justice is one of those arenas. And therefore, I think special attention, in our view, has to be paid, especially as to the way we deal with different groups, in especially in cases in which we have groups that are clearly being discriminated, marginalized, or excluded in their own perception. And that obviously involves a whole range of different potential ways to address these issues, from making the force more a police force, more inclusive, to being able to provide mechanisms of redress and all sorts of different issues of that kind. The report also looks at structural prevention issues, and here I think it's very important to say that ICC, ICJ, International Court of Arbitration, all have a particular role to play, as well as the prevention of mass atrocities being one of the issues that reserve a special focus. Then also, we looked at national prosecutions and tried to find correlation between them and potential recurrence of violence. So we're looking at the context where we have conflict, certain crimes have been committed, and national jurisdictions took basically a lead on them. And the preliminary results, which I think still needs to be further looked into, say that in the case we're looking at low and medium level perpetrators, when those are prosecuted in the national context, there's a 70% more chance of non-recurrence. However, the data seems to be suggesting going into the opposite direction when national courts take on high-level perpetrators. And in this case, there's in fact 65% more likelihood of recurrence of conflict. Now, that's something that I don't think at this point I will be able to discuss. Maybe we can come into that later. But there is certainly an idea that that national prosecutions do have an impact. So basically, with this, I would like to ask the question: how many minutes do I have? Okay, let me try to be quick on this. So the point is really, how do development and peace building frameworks then relate to policy and programs, and specifically connected to national prosecutions? So I think there's two things to be looking into very seriously, I think, from our standpoint. And these things are there to precisely address the exclusions and make the practice inclusive. So ultimately, we're looking at selection of and inclusivity of the case selection from the prosecutor's office. But that whole process needs to also be informed by a broader participation of victims from all different groups. In the process of identifying issues, but also being mainstreamed into the discussions of the peace process itself. One of the recent exceptions, obviously, of this kind was the negotiations in Havana between the government of Colombia and the FARC, where we did have the victim representatives from both sides, in fact, being involved in the consultations. And I think the more representative, so there is an idea that there are certain steps to be taken in order to have a meaningful participation, meaning that we really need to basically think of security capacity ability to associate amongst the victims. Also, because obviously without capacity, there is no meaningful participation in the process. And the victims simply don't usually have the legal background that, you know, when we come into the country and train NGOs and government officials, we often do it together, they can simply not be put into that type of training right away, and it delays the process. As a consequence, there's always somebody else who is representing the victims in these bodies, and so forth. There's all sorts of sets of security challenges, as you are probably aware. On the top of that, what is really important is the representativeness of the sample, because we always talk about you know, victims and victimization as being the central topic of what we do, but in fact, we don't necessarily have a process through which we make a survey of different kind of victim populations and make sure that they are all very well represented. So that, as a consequence of that, and as a consequence of victims not being part from all groups, and so from previous antagonized sides, not being part of this consultation, we basically also come to the point that, you know, the peace agreements don't necessarily are sufficiently inclusive. And in many cases, the prosecution strategies are not inclusive. And so we worked on specific ways of identifying criteria for assessing inclusivity of a particular prosecutorial strategies, because these are in fact paramount to address you know, exclusions and horizontal inequalities, obviously in the context in which you have a conflict and the wounds are even stronger than other cleavages you have in terms of horizontal inequalities. It is very important for the legitimacy of the judicial institution to precisely do that and be inclusive of all those involved. These criteria that are proposed can perhaps be used to get more data on this and make a link between these particular prosecutorial strategies and the ability to track down cases of recurrence and or non-recurrence of conflict. So those are some of the stakes that are involved in this. And just the final couple of words, I started talking about differences, and 1 minute. I started talking about the differences, and let me add with commonalities. I think largely in this room, there is a belief that international criminal justice is possible, and not only possible, but also necessary, given the world in which we increasingly live in. But also, I think that there's a hope that there's a future for it. It's still to happen, really, in many ways. And I just want to say that, from my own personal point of view, not talking in the name of UNDP per se, that I think the kind of statements that we need to make, and the critical viewpoint that we need to make of a kind that Greg, for example, made in the case of my own constituency. I come from Serbia. I used to work on developing capacity for national prosecutions there. Is critical to be able to actually address and champion the cause of international criminal justice, especially in cases like Gotovina, but also in some constituencies who are the champions themselves, Perisic, for example. And I'm sure in Rwanda with Nahimana, it's a very similar thing. So unless, I think we're shooting ourselves in the foot if we say, well, there's still a lot of skepticism about this project and we shouldn't be critical. I think in order to be effective, certainly in many communities, we need to be critical in a measured way in order to be able to defend precisely the institution of international criminal justice. And final words will be related to a comment that Karl Jaspers, a German philosopher, has made in his book on German guilt. He was one of the very few supporters of the Nuremberg trials at the time. And he's written a book about German guilt, which supports the the tribunal. And in his correspondence with Hannah Arendt, he was also saying that he has a strong belief that this is just the beginning. It's going to happen now, because finally, after this war, everybody understands this. And then in his second preface to this book, he said he's very disappointed. You can see from his letters and in the book, he's not sparing his disappointment. He's saying they were, you know, great powers promised this, it's going to happen, and it's not happening. And so for the final words here that he is putting down is that, you know, nation states are never going to sustain these institutions of international justice on their own. The only way to really sustain these institutions is to bring global publics on board. The institutions cannot last unless you have citizens of the world, or national citizens, the publics, who are going to be there to defend it. And if you see the situation in Finland, in the Philippines, for example, where strong gains have been made with rule of law over the last 10 years, and how they can, in fact, be reworked. There's also European countries that come to mind, such as Poland and Hungary, for example, where similar things happen. So in order to protect institutions, if you believe Carl Jaspers, you really need to build global constituencies to defend them. I'll stop with that.
Thank you for listening. For more open access audio recordings, films, and publications, go to silrap.org.